going down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin can be very, very sobering. And this is why I'm really looking forward to talk to Dominic Frisby, a brilliant, you know, comedian, researcher, author, author of, you know, quite some books, you know, Daylight Robbery, How Tax Shaped Our Past and Will Change Our Future, Bitcoin, the Future of Money. That's the one book that I've read so far. And the other one is Life After the State. And yeah, check him out on Twitter. And without further ado, we're going to talk about, you know, lots of things: nation states, governments, central banks, military industrial complex, you know, crimes against humanity, and, you know, what are the root causes, and what is the root solution. And that can only be, you know, the once in a lifetime, once in a human civilization chance, and that is Bitcoin. So we're going to talk really about a lot of aspects, and really looking forward to this talk. And I hope you're going to enjoy this. All right. Dominic Frisby, welcome to the show. How are you, man?
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Listen, I mean, I didn't know you till recently. I think the first interview was with Daniel Prince, and then I followed up on some other interviews. And I mean, your whole, you know, position and your values, your vision, we are so much on, you know, not only because you're a Bitcoiner, but because you're so critical, you question everything. I love, by the way, your writing style, you know. And since, you know, the day is only 24 hours, I just made, you know, finished the book, the Bitcoin book, you know, but I'm planning to read the other ones too, because I just, you know, love your approach to, you know, I have to dig deeper into this whole taxation and the robbery, right? So, and nation states and you know, I mean, some people come from different angles. Why don't you just tell me or my listeners about yourself? Because what I'm really curious, like, you're a comedian too, and I know, you know, the artists with a comedian or any kind of artist, they I think a lot of artists don't know. I know you do, but most artists, I have the feeling, don't know the real power they can exert in communicating, you know, when it comes to transformational, you know, to evolution, to transformation, to changing the roots of our structures. And I think, you know, as a comedian, you have the power to, you know, to make people understand with a sense of humor, with cynicism, with sarcasm, whatever that is, whatever tools you have at your disposal. So what's your journey, Dominic?
Well, I started out life as a comedian. Well, I actually started out life doing voiceovers, and then I wrote a song, and I always wanted to be a writer, and then I looked at all the best writers, and all the best writers had started out as actors. So I thought I'll start out as an actor, and then when I went to drama school, for some reason I was the best at radio. Maybe I've got a good face for radio. And so I don't know why, but I was just good at voiceovers. And I got signed up by a voiceover agent, and I just started doing voiceovers. And it was quite a nice life when you're in your early 20s. It was very well paid. You were very well treated. And so I was doing that. But you get a sort of lot of, it's not a 9-to-5 job, voiceovers. You get quite a bit of spare time. And I used to sort of write, and I wrote this song. And then I wanted to release the song as a Christmas novelty single. This would have been about 1996, 1987. And a friend of mine said, oh, no, my friend of mine was a music agent, and he said, go and do it in my brother's club. So I went and did it in his brother's comedy club, and it was a disastrous night. Everyone got booed off, and I had a really good gig. And so the people who owned the comedy club booked me for another gig. And a week later, and the next time they paid me money. And so suddenly I was a comedian with this song. And you know, combining the two incomes of being a comedian and doing voiceovers, by about the mid-noughties, I'd earned a bit of money, and I wanted to invest it. And I started, you know, reading on the internet about where to invest the money. And I discovered gold fairly quickly. It was in a big bull market at the time. And the narrative around gold really chimed with me. It made sense to me. And so I started investing in gold. And then once you start investing in gold, you realize it's a very political investment, because gold was money once upon a time. And I started learning about free markets and individual liberty and the role of the state. And suddenly, once you studied gold, you understood why house prices were so ridiculously expensive, which is something I'd never previously been able to understand before. And suddenly I understood about the creation of fiat money and so on. And there were all these really interesting people talking about gold. And I really wanted to find a way to meet them without having to pay them for their time. So I started a podcast. It was very easy for me to start a podcast, even back then in 2006. It was harder then than it is now, but for me, it was easy because I was used to microphones and things like that. So I started this podcast. I interviewed people like Jim Rogers and Mark Farber and James Turk and, you know, really clever guys. And that's how I got started. And one of the people I interviewed was this woman called Meryn Somerset Webb, who ran Money Week magazine. And she said, oh, we need people like you to come and write for us. And I said, well, I don't really know what I'm talking about. She said, it doesn't matter. Come and write for us. And so I started writing a column for Money Week in, I guess, 2007. And here we are 14 years later, still writing a weekly column for them. So that's been a nice, that's sort of how it all started. And then, you know, you meet various people. You can't really control where your life takes you. It takes you in all sorts of strange places that you didn't necessarily plan or expect. This is one of the reasons I'm so opposed to state planning, because things just, events don't just organize themselves in the way that necessarily you want them to. And this guy called Ross Ashcroft came to me and said, I've written this film, but I can't make it work. And I looked at it and I spent maybe 3 or 4 months completely rewriting it for him and re-editing it. And then that, and introduced a whole lot of new stuff to it. And that film became a film called Four Horsemen. And that was, you know, a huge hit on the internet. And that gave me the confidence to realize I could write books. And I wrote this book, Life After.
You were part of the Four Horsemen. I saw that a few months ago, I think. I didn't know that you're part of that. Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, I wasn't properly credited, so people don't know, but I wrote it and co-wrote it and narrated it as well.
Excellent.
And you know, and then from there I wrote a book called Life After the State. And it was while I was writing Four Horsemen, actually, that people started telling me about Bitcoin, and I was so swallowed up in the studios working on Four Horsemen, I should have been going to Bitcoin conferences. It would have been about 2012, 2013. Anyway, then I wrote Life After the State, and the solution of Life After the State is if we're going to save the world, we need to change our system of money. And that had like a page on it about Bitcoin. And I'm sure that's the first page on Bitcoin in a proper book. And then while I was writing it, Bitcoin started going up and up and up. And I was like, oh, I've got to write about Bitcoin because here's the free market providing the solution to the problem. And so then I wrote the Bitcoin book, and you know, I think money is being fixed. And my big thing is the two things we need to fix in the world is the first thing we need to fix is money. We need to have healthy money that, you know, one body doesn't have the power to print. It needs to be independent. Nobody can print it. Gold did that and Bitcoin does that. You know, the inflation rate is pretty much set in stone. I mean, it's set in code in Bitcoin, and in gold, the inflation rate is set because it's just rare and there just isn't that much of it. And I think gold supply grows at about 2% per annum. It grows at exactly the same rate as the population. So it's steady and constant, and there's never going to be sudden, you know, what happened to the Spaniards in the 16th century where they brought back all the gold from the Americas and created huge inflation at home and destroyed their empire. That's unlikely to happen now. But then my next theory was, is that you need to, if you're going to fix society, you need to fix the way, you need to fix money, and then you need to fix tax, because tax is the way you design a society, the way the power structures are set. And tax is inevitable. There's never been a society without taxation. But if you're going to save the world, you need to fix tax. Fix tax, you fix society. And so that's when I started work on my latest project, which is this one here, Daylight Robbery, how tax shaped our past and will change our future. So that's me.
That's working amazing
hard.
Story. Amazing.
Not as rich as I should be, but I'm doing my best.
Oh, you're doing great. So Dominic, what do you think is the, when it comes to taxes, what do you think is the perception of people? Do you think we take taxes for granted? Because I talk to a lot of people and they say, you know, if it wasn't for taxes, they would contribute voluntarily. And I think, you know, and I think it's in our nature, you know, to give back to our, you know, local community, to society, to people, you know, who, whatever that is, you know, it could be kindergarten or for the road or the infrastructure. I mean, what do you think is the perception when it comes to taxes?
Yeah, well, I completely agree with that sentiment. that, and one of the things I argue in the book is that taxation is as old as civilization itself. There's never been a society without some kind of taxation. But there is a difference between forced taxation and voluntary taxation. And there have been examples in history where societies have voluntary taxes. I agree. There's a sort of, one of the things I argue is that there a sense of duty to the greater collective existed even in the hunter-gatherer societies that predated civilization, if that makes sense. We all have this in us. We all want to give something back. And I think bizarrely, ironically, when we have the current system of taxation where it's forced and it's set in law, you are incentivized to pay as little as you legally can. Whereas in a voluntary society, you might actually find that people give more than they're expected.
Exactly.
To.
Because people have a tendency, you know, to be generous, right?
And also, like, in the way taxes are at the moment, taxes are taken. Nobody says thank you. You can't see the benefits of your spending. You have no relationship with how your money's taken and what it's spent on. Often your money is spent on things that you are morally opposed to. So, for example, I was against the Iraq war. I think most people were against the Iraq war, but our taxes were taken. We worked hard. Our taxes were taken. Our labor was effectively sequestered and spent on the Iraq war. And you know, there's the two arguments. There's the libertarian argument, which is taxation is a form of theft, and it is, because it's taken from you by force. If you don't pay taxes, you go to jail. And then there's the other argument, which is inscribed on the IRS building in America. Taxes are the price we pay for a civilized society. Well, I would, and both those statements are inherently contradictory, but they're both true. But I would argue that a civilized society does not force people to labor for things to which they are morally opposed.
I totally agree with you. So, Dominic, I mean, what do you think? You know, a few years ago, I just stopped going to the voting polls. What do you call it?
Booths.
You know, like I stopped voting because because once you understand, you know, the root causes and the structure, and I mean, why am I giving my vote away to preserve and conservate, you know, the legacy system, you know, the structure. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, red, green, blue, brown, or whatever, light, left, right wing, or conservative, or liberal, or green party. It's all the same shit. So I think, you know, if it comes to practical, like taking action, human action, you know, as we using the Austrian economist words, what would be the steps, you know, or what would be the process to make people understand, you know, as long as you're going to vote, you're going to, you know, keep the status quo as it is.
Which country are you based in?
I'm in Austria. I mean, I was born in Iran, but I came to Austria when I was 7 years old, and I grew up like 5 years in the United States. But I live in Austria for like, I don't know, 40 years or something.
And is Austria, is it a two-party system in Austria?
No, it's actually a multi-party system.
So is your government a coalition?
To be honest with you, I'm not watching any kind of mainstream news deliberately, but well, yeah it is. Yeah,
I would argue that with elections like America, for example, you know, I know they've got a libertarian party, but America is basically a two-party system. It's only really Republican or Democrat that can ever stand a realistic chance of winning. And the UK as well, we have five or six parties, but only really two can win, Labour and Conservative. And so effectively you find, and at the end of the day, an election is basically an argument of how much of GDP that they're going to spend. how big, that's effectively what the argument is. How much of your money are we going to spend?
Right.
And with a left of center government, they're going to say it's 55%. And with a right of center government, it's maybe 45% or 50%. So it's basically an argument about 2 or 3 or 4% of GDP. It's not, you're not going to achieve any meaningful change through the ballot box, the electoral system. And I don't vote. I actually draw a massive penis on my ballot paper and I give that in. So I think it's important because at least that makes a statement. But I would argue that an election, broadly speaking, is the illusion of choice.
Exactly. It's a theater.
It's a
farce.
It's a theater. The one election in my lifetime where that didn't apply was Brexit.
Yeah.
Because that was there was a definite outcome that you were voting for.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they got the outcome that they didn't want, they tried their best to stop it happening. They did everything they could to undermine it. But, you know, so when it's a referendum like that over a very definite issue, you know, should we legalize cannabis or, you know, whatever the issue is, should Edward Snowden be freed? Or, you know, when it's a definite issue and there's a referendum about it, that's different to a general election.
Right. So, Dominic, you know, let's talk about, because the underlying root problem, you know, I mean, above, you know, it's, you know, taxation, I think, is one aspect. But if we look at it, I mean, we have these power structures, right? We have this nation state, the government, in collusion, whatever, vice versa, you know, are actually the political or governmental structures are instrumentalized, in my opinion, you know, by the central banks. So if we zoom out, how would you describe, you know, to the average people out there, like, how can we like understand what needs, you know, the Bitcoin is the ultimate tool. I think this is the one in a humanity civilization chance to totally transform everything we've ever known or could ever imagine. And, you know, it's this monopoly on violence, coercion, aggression, right? It's the nation state, the government. We have the central banks that has total criminal immunity. How would you like describe or visualize for people, like, what are we, you know, what are we struggling with here, actually?
Well, the beauty of Bitcoin is that it gives you the opportunity to opt out. And you can start using Bitcoin and you no longer need to save your wealth in fiat money, in banks, in government bonds, in government assets. It gives you an escape. And it's created, the beauty of the internet and the digital economy generally is that it has also created an escape. Here is a whole new economy and you can buy and sell and trade in exchange, and you can do so beyond the control of governments. And, you know, most countries are designed around national borders, and those national borders are actually fairly new. Like, there's a great passage from a history book by A.J.P. Taylor that was written in 1940, that he describes 1914, so only 100 years ago. And he says, an Englishman could go through life and barely notice the existence of the state beyond the policeman and the postman. He didn't need to carry papers with him. He could buy and sell money anywhere in the world. He could travel anywhere in the world and he didn't need a passport. So this idea of borders and passports and all this kind of thing is fairly new. It's only about 100 years old, if that. And it was brought on by wars.
If I may just interrupt, you say, you know, I mean, I read, you know, the Bitcoin standard by Safir and Amos. That's the first time I actually understood that the gold standard, was actually abolished or, you know, gotten rid of like shortly before 1914 or around 1914, right? I think this is that's a fact that a lot of people, I missed it. I didn't learn that about that, you know, about these kind of things in school. That's a dilemma.
Yeah, no, France, They never teach you that. They talk about, they always make you learn the causes of the First World War at school, and they don't mention the gold standard. They don't mention the money. The British and the French and the German governments all abandoned the gold standard in 1914 in order to be able to print the money to pay for World War One. If those countries, if those governments had only been able to spend as much money as they had gold in their vaults, that war could not have gone on for as long as it did, right, because the governments did not have the money to pay for it. The only way they paid for it was by was fiat money, by abusing gold, the gold standard. And what was perpetrated was one of the biggest human disasters, if not the single biggest human disaster in all human history. I think if you include the Spanish flu that followed, that had its roots in the trenches, over 50 million people, 50 million people lost their lives because of the First World War. And if they'd kept their money true, it would not have been possible for it to go long on for as long as they did, as long as it did.
That's incredible. I mean, it just sometimes it's beyond the power of words to describe the crimes against humanity that's been perpetrated by these power structures. So
it's terrible.
Yeah,
gold limits, like if you look at the biggest mass murders carried out in history, they have all been carried out by rulers, whether it's kings or governments, whatever it is, it's all been carried out by rulers. And the beauty of having an independent money that no ruler can print is it limits the extent to which they can rule.
Right. And mathematics, code, cryptography, government. I mean, it's rules, yeah. Immutable, decentralized rules. There's never been, I mean, this is so ground, this is so mind-boggling. I think people haven't really thought that through. I'm sure you've been deep into the rabbit hole, and you might have maybe listened to Robert Breedlove, read some things about Robert Breedlove's articles, like how much time, and energy and everything else and resources has been stolen from humanity, through the central banking structures and governments. But it's not only that, but what kind of prosperity and abundance we could have had in the last 100 years and technological innovations in, whatever, in the last decades or in the last 100 years, if it wasn't, for these governmental nation state central banking structures and the military industrial corporate complex.
Imagine the 20th century without World War One, World War Two, and Vietnam, Iraq. Imagine it without all those wars. What an amazing time it would have been. And, if people had been able to vote, do you want the war? I think most people would have voted, no, we don't want the war. But because of the power over money made all that atrocity possible. Fiat money has caused more needless loss of life than any more loss of life than nuclear bombs.
Yeah. And I'm always trying to put it like it's important to understand the root cause. I think every person, every soul needs to go into the rabbit hole, into Bitcoin's rabbit hole. It's like so multifaceted. But once you understand, you comprehend the bigger picture and the essence of it, and then you zoom out, you really begin, as a lot of people say, I'm just paraphrasing, most people, come into Bitcoin for the money, but they stay whatever. I mean, I always say I come here, I came for the money or whatever, for number go up or for wealth and, financial monetary independence and whatever. But then, you stay for the evolution, for the vision, for the freedom, for real freedom. And this is one aspect that really fascinates me, and that's the main reason. I don't know, maybe you can tell me, what is your vision? This is a core aspect that I want to talk to you about with other guests. Like, what kind of human civilization can we create once everything is rooted in Bitcoin? Once we reach hyper-Bitcoinization, we have localized economies, we have scientists, researchers, entrepreneurs, service providers instead of governmental structures providing services, products, and we have finally 0-to-1 technological innovation coupled with deflationary economies, to quote Jeff Booth. it's like, it's so overwhelming, I think, the vision, but it's reality that we can create. So what is it that you can envision or can maybe convey to the listeners? What is possible with Bitcoin?
Well, I admire all those goals and I share all those goals and dreams, but I don't think it's going to be plain sailing. I think there's a big power struggle coming. And, you know, governments don't relinquish power easily. And they've pretty much without exception have taken on obligations, spending plans that they cannot currently meet from the revenue they generate in taxes. And so they're compensating by inflating the money and borrowing. But as they debase their currencies, and we see this, we're going to see the rise of this two-tiered economy, much as described as in the sovereign individual, where there's going to be some people who are able to move. They won't be stuck in one country. They'll be working in the digital economy. They'll be traveling from place to place, doing very well, having good lives. And then there will be other people who are stuck in the physical economy who will be burdened with heavy taxation. They will be dependent on government services. And there's going to be anger rising up between these two different groups, jealousy, envy. You look at how angry people get because Google's not paying its taxes and Apple and Amazon aren't paying its taxes. Well, that anger is going to start applying to these digital nomads, these sovereign individuals as well. And so you're going to see some wiser governments embrace them, invite them to their countries, come here, come and do business. We want your trade. We want your business. And there'll be low tax jurisdictions and they'll do fairly well. But there will be others who will try and stop them moving around, who will try and tax them, who will try and take their money. And those will be the nations that do less well. And they'll become the more authoritarian, modern, technocratic, with everyone living on UBI, you know, in virtual reality headsets, living in kind of Butlins. But or Club Med or something like that. I do think that's the thing. There'll be people, everyone's going to be in these mini Club Meds with their food giving to them and their virtual reality headsets. And so there's going to be a lot of tension between the two. And it's all very well saying, well, the Soviet Union imploded and because it couldn't meet its obligations and eventually it imploded. But it wasn't like, you know, a lot of the existing government infrastructure stayed even after the Soviet Union imploded. And so while there's a lot of hope and a lot of opportunity, for example, across Eastern Europe, you know, a lot of that implosion was pretty messy. And so I think you'll just see it'll be a bit like a field or a woodland that gets decimated by, you know, a war or a load of woodcutters or whatever come to the woodland, or a meteor strikes the woodland or whatever it is, and it just gets totally burnt out. And then you'll just see pockets, little oases, pockets of growth here, pockets of greenery there, a few flowers there. It's not all going to blossom into an amazing Amazon rainforest at once. It'll just be, you know, little pockets of growth and beauty and good places to be. And those pockets will, a lot of the basis of those economies will be in, you know, Bitcoin and free market independent money.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about, you know, what do you think about the rise or emergence of citadels and free private cities. But let me go back, yeah, to that point. You really made a good, valid point. You know, we had a talk, you know, with Eric Kaysen and Dave Collum and Eric Vasquill, and I tried, you know, to do a series of interviews, like focus like on sort of a make a reality check, because Dave Collum says, you know, the state, you know, the nation state is never going to allow Bitcoin, and they're going to whatever, really go clamp down on Bitcoiners. So, you know, it's going to be a really a pretty heavy transition phase. I totally agree with you. But how do you think it could play out, or what kind of scenarios do you think it could play out? I mean, you know, considering we have, as you said, you know, the power structures are not just going to give away the power. We're talking about like a vast military industrial intelligence complex in, you know, totally tight knit, you know, with the central banks and governments. What's the picture here?
Well, you look at what's happened with COVID, and I'm not quite sure where I stand on COVID. You know, I listen to all the arguments and I just sort of, I don't know, I haven't figured it out, but I've listened to some of the, you know, the easy explanation is that it's a virus that came from China and the governments have done their best to protect their people, and the choices they've made have been lockdowns and all the rest of it. And then I listened to some of the conspiracies, again, that it's a virus that came from China, but loads of opportunists have taken advantage of it and to impose their designs. And so, but one thing we've definitely seen as a result of COVID is that government control has increased. And you tend to see this in, it's very hard to extend control in peacetime, to raise taxes and so on in peacetime. You need the excuse of a crisis, usually a war. And then what happens after the crisis has passed is that things never go back to how they were before the crisis began. And you see, you know, the obvious example is income taxes in World War II. You know, income tax barely affected anyone before World War II. And then suddenly by the end of World War II, everyone was paying income tax and they never went back to the levels they were before the war started. Same applies to the First World War. So we've seen COVID as an excuse for incredible amounts of money printing, huge levels of debt, huge levels of government spending, unprecedented levels. And these have all become normalized. Furlough money, which is basically universal basic income by another name. Like, I was sort of in favor of universal basic income on the grounds that it simplified welfare and it treated everyone equally, everyone the same amount. Whereas furlough is like, it's like does everything UBI does, but makes it complicated and it isn't equal. So, but anyway, it's still UBI by the back door.
Yeah.
And so, but what concerns me most is the limits on movement.
Exactly.
This that is have what been really able concerns me. To yeah. be placed.
Yeah.
And it makes it very difficult for the digital nomad, the sovereign individual, to lead his life.
And connected with the, you know, the mandated vaccinations. I mean, this is the nightmare.
Yeah,
you know, we have a 4-month baby girl. And I'm like, what are we going to do? Like, if we want to travel, we have to vaccinate us and our child. I mean, this is crazy. It's insane. They haven't again, even tested it.
Well, exactly. And you can say, oh, well, the vaccination's harmless. Look, everyone's had it. But we still don't know what the long-term effects are. And, you know, there's so many. It's really... I mean, I haven't had the vaccine yet, but, you know, if I have to have it in order to travel, then I'll probably have it, albeit reluctantly. Mm. I agree, but the fact is, whether the vaccine is good for you or bad for you, it's another government control.
Right.
And I thought, you know, even with passports and visas, I thought, broadly speaking, governments were fairly in favor of free movement. But now... they seem to be changing their tune. And so, you know, that's one way by which the sort of Bitcoin sovereign individual lifestyle is not going to be as easy as we thought it was. I mean, the idea, like, I like the dream of, you know, these new, in the same way that in the olden days, if there was a mine, if somebody made a discovery and there's gold or copper or something, then they'd build a mine and then a huge city would emerge where that mine was, and, you know, a huge industry would come up there. And I rather like the idea that something similar is going to happen with Bitcoin miners and these pockets, these remote pockets of the world where energy is very cheap, but they're sparsely populated. And the energy, if the Bitcoin miner wasn't there, then there'd been no one would use that energy. And you know, suddenly whole communities are going to be spring up around these Bitcoin mines. You know, I like that idea of principle, but, you know, the Bitcoin mining community is still in another country. It's not going to be its own little citadel. And so unless Bitcoin gets to the stage where it's such a large market cap,
this is what I'm going to ask you. If the projections are correct, you know, we're going to have like a billion Bitcoin as users, you know, by 2025 or something, you know?
Yeah, but maybe the market cap of Bitcoin goes to the extent that, you know, a bunch of Bitcoiners can get together and go to, you know, the government of Liberia or the government of wherever and say, we want to buy however many acres of land, you know, we want to buy 50,000 hectares of land off you, and we want you to recognize it as an independent nation state. And it might be that some countries are so desperate for Bitcoins because fiat's lost all its money that they will be prepared to sell you land, and then these sovereign states can be built.
The problem, that's
a long way to go before we get to that. And it's not clear, you know, Liberia, or I'm just using Liberia because it's the first African country that came to mind, but it could be Mali, it could be anyway, Chad, you know, right, Chad, I want to buy this chunk of desert right in the middle of Chad. Nobody uses it. And I'm going to send up an independent, I'm going to build an airport there and build an independent nation state. You know, would Chad recognize it? It might well, and they would have to hire an army to defend its borders, and this community could arise. But would the UN recognize this new country?
Right.
Because the UN might not want all these new nations, these competitive, dynamic, low-tax citadels springing up. So it might be that the citadels will only exist in the digital world. They'll only exist in Decentraland. They'll only exist in our minds, in virtual reality. They won't actually exist in the physical world. The digital conquest has already happened, but the physical conquest is a different game altogether. Unless we get massive hyperinflation,
right,
and fiat money starts losing its value, at which point, you know, the world can change very quickly.
And it's already in the process. I mean, look at this, the whole global debt and, you know, the printing of whatever creation, you know, of trillions and trillions. I mean, the M2 money supply, it's just mind-boggling. Like it's pre-programmed, self-destruction. What else?
Sure,
is it?
But, you know, Rome was debasing its currency, it took 300, 400 years.
Okay.
And then, you know, it takes a long time. And you know, how long have we been debasing money for? Since 1914, since 1971, since 2000, since 2008. You know, these are all big events that led to accelerated debasement. 2020, of course, being the next one. But you know, I just think there's too much. Are people going to suddenly stop using euros and US dollars and sterling? They're not. It's too much. There's too much skin in the game.
Right. So, I don't know. I mean, if, you know, if we reach a critical mass, if we reach hyper-Bitcoinization, if the game theory, the incentivization game, you know, plays out, what do you think?
Hyper-Bitcoinization is a more likely, hyper-Bitcoinization is a more real possibility than total hyperinflation and monetary collapse of fiat.
Right. Exactly,
and if that makes
you
sense.
Addition to that, you know, if you have like key players or decision makers, and we already see them, you know, it's not like everything white and black. I mean, I do recognize, you know, there are politicians, decision makers, senators, Congress people, whatever, you know, like key people in decision making processes. That, you know, they carry within themselves the ethical principles. They see the vision, they understand. Maybe they're not doing it for themselves, but maybe for the posterity, for the children. So maybe there's a game theory playing out, and eventually we will have like more secessions, you know, like states seceding from the federal entities, or you know, citadels, free private cities, or localized economies everywhere fracturized. Maybe this is the way to go, because let's play out the whole decentralization game, you know.
It's listen, I'd love that if it happened, but look at what happened in Catalonia. You know, Scotland's been talking about succeeding, but they're not even going to get their vote. And look at, you know, Britain tried to secede from the European Union
Failed.
They tried to stop that.
Yeah.
You know, look what happened when the Confederate States tried to secede from the United States. You know, they had a war that went on for 5 years and killed however many millions, and they didn't get their way. So, you know, secession is nice in principle, but governments will not allow it willingly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, the smaller power, you know, Catalonia might, the Catalonians might want secession, but the Catalonian army can't beat the Spanish army. So if Spain decides to send in the tanks to impose unity, there's not a lot that Catalonia can do about it.
Okay, so we're coming back to, you know, square one. I mean, it's these control structures and the centralized structures, especially the military industrial, whatever governmental structures that will, what do you think is the worst case scenario? Do you think we're going to have civil wars or do you think they're going to trigger whatever, a war by, you know, perpetrating a false flag, or is there like scenarios you've already thought about?
Yeah, I thought about it a bit. I quite like that theory that there's never been a war between two countries that both have McDonald's.
That's a good
have
one.
You ever heard that?
Yeah, no, something similar like that, yeah. That's awesome.
And so I think that, you know, there's some, I think there's been an example where that rule has been broken. I forget what it was, but so there's some truth to that. And, you know, I can't see, for example, like England and France, for example, have been fighting for, you know, 1,000 years, England and France. We've been, you know, and every now and then France conquers a bit of England, and every now and then England conquers a bit of France. And the other day, Jersey, which is one of the English islands, but really it should be French because it's like 10 miles off the coast of France.
Right.
And for some reason it's English. Or maybe it's more than 10 miles. But anyway, it's much closer to Normandy than it is to England. You know, there was an argument. I think the French threatened to turn off Jersey's power.
Mm-hmm.
And so in an argument over fish. And so the English sent in the Royal Navy. Now, this is last week. Now, I can't realistically see, you know, I can see all the flexing of muscles, and mm-hmm. Macron always likes to inspire anti-English sentiment in France with his rhetoric. But I can't actually see France and England in this day and age actually going to war. But I do think, you know, here's another reason. And you can say, well, we're going to get civil wars. And in a way, we're already having civil wars. You know, we're in this huge period of division between left and right, between authoritarian and libertarian, between, you know, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, between Remain and Brexit, between
distractions.
You know, yeah, but they're all genuine divisions.
Yeah,
and you know, there's a cultural war going on pretty much everywhere, mm-hmm. and so. But, and there might be a riot and there might be a fight, but the difference, like 500 years ago, if you wanted to have a revolt, you know, the working people could actually win because there wasn't such a gulf between the weapons that both side has. But in the UK and in Western Europe, you know, the people don't have guns and the government does have guns. So the government has total power. It's slightly different in America, obviously, but here in the West, you know, it's pretty much impossible to overthrow your government except at the ballot box. Yeah. And we've already discussed how impossible that is. So even a civil war is unlikely. And so we have this sort of, it's a war of words between countries, but I don't think it's actually going to be a war of guns. But there is definitely a war, you know, America and China are having a sort of proxy war.
Mm-hmm.
And if you buy the idea that COVID was a deliberate chemical attack, then, you know, there's could be a chemical war. But I think the days of, for example, you know, Austria going to war with Hungary and England going to war with France, I think those days are are gone. I don't see that as a realistic possibility. And I do, but I do see, you know, for example, France imposed very heavy taxes about 5 or 6 years ago, a wealth tax on the super rich in France, and all the super rich in France came to London. And as a result, and so in terms of population, London is now the fifth biggest city in France by population of French.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
So I see those kind of competitions going on. Just hold on 1 second. Somebody's calling me and I do need to speak to them.
Sure. Should I stop it?
No, it's okay. I just email them.
Sure. Yeah, I want to wrap this up anyway, Dominic. I want to respect your time and want to ask you, like, on a positive note, because I know you have children of your own. Like, do you have 3 kids or something?
Four.
You have 4 children, yeah, but four. Probably grown up or more or less, right? I mean,
20. Do I look that old? They're no, 20, just... 18, 16, and 15.
Yeah, okay, because I saw the foreword, you know, like whom you dedicated the book to.
Oh, and, I see. Okay.
You know, no, the reason I'm asking, you know, my girlfriend, we have a 4 month baby girl, you know, we love her, you know, like you do your children more than life. Trying to end this on a positive note, what do you think, are our children gonna, in what kind of world are they gonna live in? What kind of civilization are they gonna prosper, evolve? Are we going to finally, you know, experience true freedom, you know, and prosperity and evolution in, let's say, whatever, 10, 15 years?
There's a contradiction there, because there's different sorts of freedom. Right. So I use the level of to which you're taxed as a measure of freedom. How much of your own labor do you own? So in North Korea, a worker owns 0% or maybe 10% of his own labor. And in an anarchy where there's no taxation, the worker owns all of his own labor. And in the social democracies of the West, we're somewhere around 45-50% of GDP. So we own about half of our own labor. At the turn of the 20th century, that figure was about 10%. So in that respect, we are much less free than we were at the turn of the 20th century, than we were 100 years ago. Much less free. But on the other hand, we have the internet, we have smartphones, we have computers, we have aeroplanes, we have cars, we have telephones, we have a million things that we can do now that just were not possible then. We can fly anywhere in the world, drive anywhere in the world, sail anywhere in the world, access to unlimited communication. We can talk to anyone anywhere in the world. So in that respect, we're much more empowered and much more free than we've ever been. So, you know, it's a bit of a balance there. But in terms of things like life expectancy, and quality, like you could take the poorest woman in London or the poorest woman in Paris, and she would have a lifestyle that is infinitely better than Marie Antoinette.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially with Bitcoin, Dominic, right? I mean, it's a hardest, scarcest money we've ever, been discovered.
Sure, but leave aside Bitcoin.
Right.
Leave
okay. Gotcha.
Bitcoin for the second.
Okay.
Like, because let's assume that the poorest woman in London doesn't own any Bitcoin, but she still has a smartphone, and homeless people have smartphones. She has access to running water, to electricity, to motorized transport. She has access to all these things that Marie Antoinette never had. So, of course, she never has the status that Marie Antoinette had. So in many ways, even for the very poorest people, life is better now than it was 50 or 100 or 200 or 300 years ago in many ways. So in that respect, you have to say that life is getting continually better. We're living longer. We enjoy higher standards of living. There are many things we've lost. We've lost communities. We've lost the sense of family, the unity of family that once existed. We've lost a lot of camaraderie. We've lost contact with nature. But these are all things that can be solved and we're rediscovering. So there's many things that we've lost, But on the whole, I would say the lives that our children have are likely to be better than the lives that we had. But there's going to be a cluster flip of mess to do with government that they're going to have to navigate along the way. But even so, you know, we only notice history is one constant evolutionary process of improvement, punctuated with lots of bad things that happen on the way. Mm-hmm. Now, the constant gradual, like if you compare the first iPhone that you could get in 2008, whenever it first came out, compared to the iPhone now,
right,
they're like two different machines.
Right.
But over the course of each iPhone, you don't really notice it. It's only when you take two distinct things at two extremes that you notice the improvement. And so you don't see this in the news. You don't see they don't report good news. They only report the bad stuff.
Yeah.
So you constantly think, oh shit, it's getting worse. It's getting worse, because the general cumulative, you know, this is the power of compound interest that goes unreported. So it's important to stand back and recognize that actually we're quite lucky to be born when we're born. We're probably born at one of the best times in history to be born. You know, even, you know, life now is probably better than it was in the enlightened societies of ancient China or ancient Greece. No matter how enlightened they were, life's probably better now. So I think we do need to recognize that.
Yeah, you know, Dominic, the reason I brought up Bitcoin, of course, is because you mentioned at the beginning, you know, UBI. You know, I'm to be honest with you, I'm for the transition phase. I'm totally for UBI. But the thing is, we don't even need UBI once we are rooted, you know, in Bitcoin, as you know, with the hard scarce money, with localized economies, with deflationary technologies, because it is the savings technology, because it will appreciate exponentially in purchasing power. So people finally, you know, have a cushion, have a, you know, a financial and monetary, you know, existential pillow, you know, to rest on. This is why I brought this up. But I really enjoyed our conversation, Dominic. Is there anything, final thoughts or links or infos you want to give my listeners?
No, I'm sorry that I got interrupted in the middle of it, but I'm back in the room. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. I always enjoy talking about all of these subjects. And there's lots to be optimistic about. There's lots to be worried about. And we all need to go quietly about our business of overthrowing the system.
I love your subtle style.
Do it discreetly.
Exactly.
Do it discreetly.
Discreetly. Well, in that sense, well, thank you so much, Dominic. I hope to, you know, we can repeat this maybe sometime in the form of a panel discussion in the future. But it was really amazing. So lots of things to think about. All right.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Take care. All right. So I really enjoyed this talk with Dominic. I was really looking forward. He's a comedian. He's a really, you know, amazing researcher, author. Is in my eyes, you know, also an investigative reporter. He's got amazingly critical thinking and views and perspectives. So I wanted to have him on. Make sure you follow him on Twitter and read his books, Daylight Robbery and Bitcoin, the Future of Money and Life After the State. And yeah, if you have any questions, suggestions, let me know. My email address is kd@kvandavani.com. I'm the host of the K. Vandavani Connection Show. And make sure you follow me on Twitter, subscribe to my YouTube channel and podcast platforms, and I'll see you around. Thanks, bye.